Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to continue the theme of looking at the Siege of Leningrad, which is something we were exploring in a podcast probably a few weeks ago now. So previously we'd looked at how Hitler had planned for Moscow to fall, but for Leningrad to be surrounded and starved out of existence. The typical Nazi arrogance rested on the premise that the city wasn't worth invading. It could simply be cut off and starved to death. But for Hitler, Leningrad had a special significance. This was the home of the October Revolution, the place where, in his view, Jewish Judeo-Bolshevism emerged from. And it was going to be the triumph of Nazi ideas to destroy the birthplace of the Russian Revolution. During the siege, in which over a million Russians died, the party hierarchy within the city managed to maintain a fairly high standard of living. There are large numbers of evacuations by air as party bosses and NKVD men were taken to safer parts of Russia. In addition to this, the Leningrad Symphony, for example, was composed by Dmitri Shostakovich, part of the kind of Stalin's symbolic resistance to the siege. But if you contrast the conditions of the musicians who played the symphony, which was broadcast not only to Leningrad but to the besieging troops, if you contrast the condition of those musicians who were virtually starving when they played the symphony to that of the party bosses, the contrast is profound. There were regular meals cooked at the Smolny Institute, where the revolution had been managed and planned. And even in the Smolny Institute, there was a private cinema, there was central heating, there were ideal conditions for the party bosses in which to live. This sort of appalling cynicism and hypocrisy and a total abrogation of any kind of egalitarian ideas that the revolution was supposedly based on became a public knowledge. There were angry leafleters who was distributed across the city, messages to the workers and soldiers of Leningrad about the deception of their political masters. Many of these were people caught and arrested and sent to the firing squad. But an awful lot of effort was put into maintaining the rule by the secret police during the siege. When it looked like law and order was breaking down in Moscow, some of the first people to be attacked by the public were the NKVD. After the war, Stalin became increasingly mindful that during the many long months of the siege, that Leningrad had become its own sort of independent little state. Leningrad had managed to survive without the governance of Stalin and the Politburo. And Stalin was very wary of Leningrad after the war and saw it as a possible site for dissent. Certainly, the defenders of Leningrad had a far more heroic status than Stalin was comfortable with. In late 1941, Lake Lagoda froze and became a link to the rest of Russia. The Red Army built a six-lane ice highway with 30,000 civilian workers that kept Leningrad fed. 4,000 vehicles, 4,000 lorries were driving across the road of life. But incoming supplies, which were initially at 700 tons a day, tended not to reach citizens. Stalin ordered that there should be a new attack to break out of the encirclement. This, of course, fails. And this is up until the Battle of Kursk. Stalin would continue to make the same old mistakes of ordering the kinds of attacks that his generals thought were unfeasible and impossible, and assuming that political will and political ardour would triumph in the end. When Stalin makes the decision later on in the war to listen to his generals, it's the kind of decision that Hitler fails to make, with notable outcomes on either side. In All Hell Let Loose, Max Hastings quotes a radio operator on the east of the city, Nikolai Nikulnin, who wrote, "I learned what war was really like. One quiet night I was sitting in my icy hall, unable to sleep because of the cold, scratching my lice-infested body, crying from weakness and misery. In an empty German dugout I found some potatoes, frozen hard as stones, made a fire and boiled them in my helmet. With food in my stomach I gained spirit. I started to change after that night, developing defence mechanisms, an instinct for self-preservation, staying power. I learned how to find grub. Once a horse that was pulling a sledge near us was killed by a shell. 20 minutes later, little was left of it, save the mane and guts. Because smart guys like me dismembered it. The driver hadn't even recovered from the shock. He just sat on the sledge, clutching the reins." So that gives you an indication of the scale of hardship that faced Russian soldiers who were attempting to defend Leningrad and break out of the blockade. There was a loss of 20 Soviet divisions in attempts to relieve Leningrad, and there was only one significant success, which was the recapture of a rail junction at Tikhvin on the 9th of December, and this made it possible to move supplies to a railhead within a distant reach of the city. This did nothing to alleviate hunger. On the 13th of January, one Leningrad diarist, Elena Kochina, wrote that about her bread ration collection, who she was queuing in the snow to receive her ration and was about to eat it right away, which is advisable, just as in the Nazi death camps, hanging around with available bread in one's pocket was an invitation to be robbed. She wrote that a man grabbed her bread from her and she fought back. He fell to the ground. I fell with him. Lying on his back, he tried to cram the whole piece of bread into his mouth at once. With one hand, I grabbed him by the nose, turning it aside. With the other, I tried to tear the roll out of his mouth. The man resisted, but more and more weakly. Finally, I succeeded in retrieving everything he hadn't managed to swallow. People watched our struggle in silence. The theft of ration cards, the theft of food, these were potentially life-threatening experiences. The average number of calories per day being so low. And the emergence of cannibalism during the siege was quite well documented. For example, there had been 42 cases in the first 10 days of January 1942 reported. In February that month, there were 20,000 people each day reported to be dying. The thing about famines is it's rarely actually ever the starvation that kills. It's diseases that are the chief killer during a famine period. This is because the immune system is compromised, and because during periods of famine, things like sanitation also tend to break down as well. And in this case, dysentery was by far the most serious threat. The lack of running water, the need to queue at street taps, all added to the poor sanitation that allowed disease to sweep through the city. Their number of coffins ran out. There was no means to put out fires when they began, in some cases due to shelling. And the city empties of people as people return to the only place where they can conserve their energies, the family home. When the ice highway opened over Lake Lagoda, there were a small trickle of evacuations, but Stalin refused to allow the city to be evacuated en masse, as it would be a propaganda victory for the Nazis, much as in the same way he refuses for Stalingrad to be evacuated. He believed that Soviet citizens should stand and fight for their homes. Again, a monstrously brutal and foolish idea. One thing that was unclear to the Western Allies was the extent of the damage done to the Wehrmacht in Russia, to the German army. The British and the Americans were terrified at the thought that the Soviet Union might fall, but they were, and this is what they profoundly expected throughout all of 1942. However, they didn't really understand the scale of losses and the exhaustion of human manpower that Hitler had put the Wehrmacht through. At the end of 1941, 2 million German soldiers in the bitter cold of Russia, their improvised, basically summer uniforms, stuffed with things like straw and old newspaper to keep them warm, found that they were in a situation, ironically, almost as dire as the people they besieged. One German soldier.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hans-Jürgen Hartmann wrote from Kharkov. I've often wondered what this Christmas might be like. I've always cast out the war from my imaginary picture, or at least push it to the very edges. I conjured up special words for the occasion. Christmas, homeland, longing, joy and hope. Yet these words, always sincere and heartfelt, became increasingly strange and precious to me. They evoked something timeless, precious, and yet the conditions of the Eastern Front seemed scarcely believable anymore. How brutal this war is becoming. It is now a total war, a war against women, children and old people. That is the greatest horror. It would be soldiers like Hans-Jürgen Hartmann who would understand full well the likely fate of Germany if the war turned the other way. Soldiers of the Wehrmacht fought tenaciously against the Red Army, desperate to prevent Soviet boots setting foot on German soil, partly because they knew of the savagery of the Wehrmacht in Russia, the war of annihilation that had been inflicted on the Russians. And when the news of not just German defeats in Russia, but also German crimes in Russia, filtered back to the civilian population in Germany, so a general feeling of what might be in store for the German people began to emerge. Another German soldier, Franz Peters, and some of his fellow soldiers found a church in a small town at Christmas. Obviously, the communist regime had long since torn out the altar, but the German soldiers clustered around where it had once been and began to sing carols. "I have never heard Silent Night sung with such fervour," he said. Many of us were moved to tears. Another soldier, Karl Gottfried Wirkum, read out a Christmas card that had been sent by his mother from Germany. "When I finished, there was complete silence. Far away from this terrible disaster, which no one imagined possible when we first entered Russia, something else still existed. Was there a Christmas somewhere, still a Christmas somewhere, where people peacefully exchanged gifts, gathered around the tree and went to midnight mass?" In Berlin, the reaction that Hitler had to the change in German fortunes outside Moscow was a typical act of Führer petulance. He was furious that Moscow had not been seized as he had hoped for. Even though the reasons for this were largely his fault. And he replaced Walter von Brauchitsch with himself as the commander-in-chief of the army. He told Model that there should be no retreat, no yielding of any territory. And one of the advocates of strategic disengagement, or strategic withdrawal and regrouping, General Hoepner, wrote, This is a serious cost to one's nerves, fighting against the enemy and one's own supreme commander at the same time. This very quickly followed him, followed with his sacking shortly afterwards. By mid-January, however, the situation for the Germans had stabilised. The advance of the Red Army had stopped, and on the 21st, the Germans were able to launch a counter-offensive at the Russian flank west of Moscow. Of course, Hitler took credit for this and claimed that this was his victory. And the problem for the German army from here on would be that Hitler's belief in the correctness of his own thinking, the rightness of his own thinking, of refusing to countenance any kind of strategic withdrawal, would doom the German army in campaign after campaign, where Hitler could rightly, or perhaps not rightly, but with some degree of self-justification, look at Moscow and say, there you are. There is the evidence that strategic withdrawals don't work and that standing your ground, fighting to the last man, is the way this war will be won. And he was right once in Moscow and then wrong every other time. Or perhaps it's fair to say that at Moscow, he appears to be right. And in order to have the kind of defence he spoke of, incalculable human costs of men and material needed to be endured. Finally, for the men of the Wehrmacht, something was being done about the cold. Heated shelters were set up for recuperation between hours in the cold and activity. And there were obviously only a short period that soldiers without heavy winter equipment could bear. In addition to this, snow shelters were built around Luftwaffe engines to warm them through the long cold nights and to keep them from freezing up. And this enabled aircraft to fly again. So the poor preparation for the cold winter weather was just about mitigated by some of the innovations that Model introduced in late January 1942. And this enabled them to start to take the fight to the Russians once more. During the renewed fighting, there were terrific cruelties on either side, and what is clear is that both sides, since the beginning of Barbarossa, had become increasingly indifferent to cruelty. The Russian front seems to have been a kind of out of much of the war, a theatre of brutalisation, where there was no room for any kind of mercy or pity. Perhaps this is something to do with the actual terrain and the elements itself, but a lot of it is to do with some of the ideas that Hitler announced prior to the invasion of it being a war of annihilation. However, the Soviets were willing to trade bodies and lives for territory. And the fact that 175 miles of territory had been gained between and there had been a push back from the gates of Moscow was considered to be quite a triumph in the Kremlin. From the start of Barbarossa till the end of January 1942, the Germans had suffered almost 1 million casualties, which was one in four of all the soldiers originally committed to Barbarossa. And the winter of 1941-42 was an opportunity for the Germans to try to rebuild their defences and their formations. So in France and in Poland, in 1939 and 1940, respectively, Blitzkrieg had worked well. The thing about Blitzkrieg Lightning War is that it's meant to be quick, and this is obviously a difficulty when you have a much larger country. Barbarossa was dependent for success on the destruction of Stalin's armies west of the Dnieper River. And the problem was that not only could Stalin's armies withdraw deeper into the country, but the Red Army could call on ever greater resources of manpower. German generals were amazed at the speed and the rapidity in which divisions could just simply be replaced. And the longer the supply line, the greater the problems the Wehrmacht have, and the longer the campaign, the greater the problems the Wehrmacht have. They're not really, as a fighting force, geared up to long sieges, particularly. There was inadequate infrastructure in Russia to actually seize. The conquest of France meant that Hitler could be in Paris fairly quickly on a train. There is a very weak rail network, a very weak road network in Russia, and that meant that getting fuel and equipment to troops became more and more difficult the longer the supply lines grew. The other problem was that the men who fought in the Moscow campaign, their belief in the Führer, their belief in the Wehrmacht, invariably was shattered, and their belief in the likely outcome, victorious outcome of Barbarossa, was shattered as well. They saw comparatively well-equipped Soviet troops, particularly Arctic soldiers in heavy warm Arctic clothes, skis, and rifles that didn't jam in the cold. And there was a realization that the Germans had underestimated their enemy, and this was a morale-shattering moment. The idea that Russian soldiers were resilient and capable and intelligent, and that their leadership was willing to sacrifice whatever it took to defeat the Germans. Okay, so we're going to continue this next time. Many apologies, by the way. I've been out of action for a week or two with a child-inherited virus. So there you go. Sorry if I've not been keeping you guys up to date. Remember to pop by our Patreon page. I'm adding some new and interesting journalism there at the moment. And many, many thanks for our recent supporters to Patreon. It's been hugely, hugely gratifying to have the support of Bill in Hawaii and Skip, wherever you are. Anyway, thanks very much, everybody, and I'll catch you on the next podcast soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.